It takes forever to build trust. It takes a second to lose it. And the flip side is I have to give my deputies instantaneous trust. The minute they come work for me, I trust them. They are part of my team. They don't have to prove themselves to me. They've already done that through the work they did to get to where they are. The flip side is I fully expect that I have to prove myself to them before they will trust me. Right. And so there's this constant work on developing that trust.
Hey guys, if you missed out on the last conference in Nashville, Tennessee, you don't want to miss out on the next one. It's April 28th through May 3rd, Orlando, Florida, the Gaylord Palms Resort and Convention Center. You made a mistake missing the last one. You don't want that to happen again on this one. 5 days of some of the best training you're ever going to experience packed into one event. We have an early bird special right now, $50 off. Use 24 early bird on our website, streetcop.com. Look for the conference, click the link, register today. If you want to get significantly better at this profession in 5 days, don't dare miss out on the 2024 Street Cop Conference. 111, 110.
Street Cop.
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and we have with us a reoccurring guest. I believe the first time I was ever invited on a podcast was actually his. So I got my debut as a guest on the squad room, but this is a reoccurring thing, and this won't be the last time you see him. We're thankful to have back our guest, Garrett Tesla. How do you think somebody is comfortable with knowing that they're not liked at an agency as a supervisor? How do you think so? For and the reason I ask that is because it's flabbergasting to me from two guys who are on the same page. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, this is no relevance to your agency. I'm saying just in general, I always wonder, how are you so comfortable knowing that people don't like you? I think one of my first answers to that, and I'll answer my question very briefly, is you found others like you and you justify your behavior through their shit behavior as well. So enablers, I think, is probably one of the biggest things. Because usually when you have a shit person at the top or an administration, usually have a like shit little Geppetto with them, a little fucking puppet that floats along with them. It's usually a two-man team, right? Or a two-woman team, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But how do you concede that when you go to work as the quote-unquote leader, which you're not, you're a manager, that you know people hate you and you're okay with that? I have to acknowledge doing this work that I'm doing, mm-hmm. that people may not like me. I may rub them the wrong way. Mm-hmm. But I just said, I was on a phone with Jay Dobbins before. And, you know, you know Jay Dobbins. Yeah, Jay's a good dude.
Yeah.
And so we were on the phone for an hour and 15 minutes. And you know, the reality of it, and I say this, and I'll say it publicly, you're going to find people that don't like me, Jay, or a new friendship. Mm-hmm. But you're never going to find somebody that tells you that I'm a snake, I scumbagged them, I was kicking people while they were down, I put knives in people's backs, I got on my knees to get things. Like that will never be associated with me. I make mistakes.
Right.
I make mistakes. I'm trying things. I'm a human being. I make mistakes, but I never consciously could live with the idea that people thought that I was a piece of shit.
And I think you just made an important distinction too, because to be the leader, like the guy whose name is on above the door, so to speak, like you have to be comfortable making decisions that are not popular. And you have to be comfortable with the fact that people aren't going to like those decisions, because I think the flip side is if you get some kind of sycophant who is just out there chasing the likes and wants to be supervisor of the year everywhere and every year and is like, you know, doing things the wrong way to get the likes, there's that too. Right. And they don't have any spine to them because they're not willing to stand up to people. So that is its own problem. So I think what you just said is important for people to tease out is that you have to be comfortable making unpopular decisions, but you can do it in a way that people know you're not the snake. You're not out to burn people. You're doing it for the good of the agency or for the good of even the employees. But you have to do a lot of explanation and understand that, you know, that part people may not understand, may not like, but that your intentions are above reproach. That's the hard part in any leadership position, is being well-liked so that you can be well-received and that people can will give you a chance. Because that's really all you get when you're in a position of any sort of leadership, especially once you enter management. It takes forever to build trust. It takes a second to lose it. And the flip side is I have to give my deputies instantaneous trust. The minute they come work for me, I trust them. They are part of my team. They don't have to prove themselves to me. They've already done that through the work they did to get to where they are. The flip side is I fully expect that I have to prove myself to them before they will trust me. Right. And so there's this constant work on developing that trust between the two of us. And so when I make an unpopular decision, they hopefully have learned to trust me enough to know that my intention is true and that my concerns are valid. But that doesn't mean that I am the bad person there, if that makes sense.
You know, I think there really needs to be some more acknowledgement in this profession, maybe in the world of leadership versus management. And really,
oh, absolutely,
just claim yourself to be a manager. And we could all live with that, but don't do things that are anti-leader-like.
Yeah.
And then claim that you're a leader of an organization because you're not. So if you're a manager, just say, yeah, I'm the manager here. That's the way it goes. And so when I think about you saying having to deliver bad news, unpopular things that you have to report to your rank and file, I think a manager just delivers it. And I think a leader thinks about how they're going to deliver it so it's received well.
Absolutely. There's really three things that we confuse, especially in law enforcement. We confuse management with leadership, but also with supervision, right? You lead people, right? And then you manage an asset and you supervise a process. Those are different things. And so when we work through the lens of leading the people through a process that we supervise them on, or we lead them as, and then we manage them as an asset of the agency, but we lead first. That is where I think the juice is.
Doing boss shit as a boss is probably the most difficult thing about being a boss. And let's just back up for a second before you get ahead of me. When I say boss shit, I'm not talking about you get to drive the nice car, you get the take home, you get this, you get the good schedule, you get to do things at your leisure and discretion. I'm talking about there. That's one half of it. But the other half of it is the dirty work. And the dirty work is not something that you choose to do. It is sometimes things that need to get done. How you do your dirty work is up to you, but the dirty work must get done. And so in that sense, I often wonder how police agencies and organizations in general might even have a good chief at the top, decent guy, decent girl, but allows there to be somebody in middle management to be a complete asshole. For me, I can't understand this, but I do know why that happens. And I'll tell you why. As a leader of an organization with employees, the worst thing that I have to do is have hard conversations. I hate it.
Yep.
But I also understand that I have to be able to do that in order for this to be successful. And I got to tell you, at the other end of the rainbow of a hard conversation is an actual solution and respect. So the problem is people want to run from the hard conversations, from the uncomfortable things. They only want to do the comfortable shit. Mm-hmm. And in law enforcement and public service in general, you don't have to address things because no matter how you perform, you're still going to get paid the same. There's essentially only so much you can make as a cop. That's the bottom line. And Right. Where in private industry, even my industry being private, I'm in police training, I'm in police media, I'm in police information. So we are a police organization, but we are a private entity. And to be honest with you, it's abundant. If you know how to understand what abundance means, it's abundant. There's no cap on how much money I can make. I can do three more classes in a week and increase my salary. I choose not to do that because I'm playing a different game, but the reality is I don't have a choice because if I don't make those decisions to have those hard conversations, in the long run, the consequences are so severe, they're so dire that they could actually sink an organization. Yet, when there's a guaranteed paycheck, no matter what happens, it seems to be like, well, who cares? I'm going to get paid no matter what. Place is not going to close down because I don't do this leadership stuff. So what's your thoughts when I say something like that?
You're dead on. It's like, and then you've got other things that through unintended consequences or intentional consequences add to that, right? So you have what are in California, we call them POBR, Peace Officer Bill of Rights, you know, things that prevent agencies from just outright firing you. That's not everywhere. There's a lot of agencies that still can like jam people up for dumb stuff and, you know, get rid of good people. But in other times, there are times where that whole process kind of obstructs getting rid of the good people. But then there's the, yeah, the so government civil service work is really hard to fire people from. Like you just said, you get paid the same. Why should I do more when it takes more effort? And we're seeing that, you know. And then you have the chain of command system where it's really, really easy for a sergeant to make it a lieutenant's problem, to make it a captain's problem, to make it a assistant chief's problem. And then everyone just points to the guy in the back office on Mahogany Row and says, man, that guy's not doing anything about it, right? Because all those other people in between aren't doing what you just said, which was having the hard conversation. You know, everybody knows what's going on in the agency. Not everybody knows, but we all have a good idea of what's happening within arm's reach of us in an agency, right? And if you don't, shame on you. And that goes for any rank. But when we're not willing to step up and have those hard conversations, and, you know, I look at it as it really starts with the people who are FTOs in your organization too. And how do they lead even when they're not training someone, you know, and how are they taking that responsibility? And it works up. And if every rank were to take some responsibility for having the conversation and first off holding themselves accountable for their own attitude and what they bring to work, but then if you do that, you get to hold other people accountable without being out of integrity with yourself. And you know, that's how we change our culture, I think.
The one variable to fix things in this industry is you have to care about something more than yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the root causes of problems in this industry, and I'll probably argue that any industry, is self-interested behavior. And so what you will find is, and I think that comes down to the fact that there's so little to go around. Because there's limited resources, and let's talk about just money in general, there's limited rank, limited money. There is competition. You have tests to try to get more money. It's cutthroat. You have tests and processes to try to get a better schedule or a better job. All these things, that's what drives some of this bad behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, I have this thought in my mind, and it really comes from a good place. As weird as this may sound, where I really have this dream, I'd like to bring 10 of the worst police supervisors into this room and record and have a roundtable discussion to have them explain to me why they behave the way they do. I'm just like, you know, why did you, they'll never do it, but I'm just trying to understand from a person who's good to try to understand a person who's bad. Hmm. And I don't mean the bad in the sense of like they're out committing crime, like, according right. to the law, they're not breaking the law. I'm talking of a bad human being. Where does that come from? How are you comfortable being a bad human being? And we all make mistakes, right? I'm going to be 42 in November. I continue to grow as a human. And one thing in my 40s that I'm getting more and more of is compassion for other people. Mm. Like, dude, I almost have, it would be hard for you to get me to not like somebody. No bullshit. Even yeah. people you think that are my biggest enemies, I look beyond it and I say to myself, what's causing that? Why is that happening? Why is that person acting that way towards us? It's not mm-hmm. a Dennis Bonino thing. It's a them thing. So right. where are they getting their butt kicked? And that's what I just want to know. And sometimes yeah. when I catch people who I think are my quote unquote friends doing things that they didn't think I was going to find out about, I don't like scream and tell them like, fuck you, all this crazy stuff. I say, why would you do that? Like, just tell me about like why you would do that. Mm-hmm. What did I ever do to you? And you know, the guilt is like, I know you're right, dude. I don't know why. I was like, just kind of got caught up in something. And like, they were doing it and I was doing it. I understand. I just want to know why. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's because they're in a bad place.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and we don't help ourselves out in from an agency perspective of bringing people into leadership positions who aren't ready for it or who have a background where, you know, they learn these things. Just, you know, you can point easily to that's how they learned it when they were a rookie. You know, they had someone before them that taught them the wrong way to lead. It's not really leadership at all, but the top taught them the wrong way to manage people, right? And they just assume that's the way to do it. Or that's where they grew up with. And they grew up with an authoritarian who kind of ran the ship that way at home, or teachers, or they just have an absence of self-awareness about those things. And they come into it. The biggest issue I see with people is they come into a leadership position and they have no interest in self-development, no interest in inquiring as to why they get upset or they get frustrated with people or why they don't have compassion for people or why.
Well, we don't set a standard, right? We don't say, like, if you can't learn how to lead, you're done being a leader. Like, we don't say, like, here's your chevrons. You got 6 months to figure it out. If it comes back that you're not doing a good job, you're not developing your leadership skills, you're done. You're going back to rank and file.
Yeah.
We don't say that. We say, look, here's your chevrons. You're right. Welcome to the fucking mafia, right? Welcome to the club.
Right.
You're right. You're a made man now. Right. No more quarterly reviews, no more annual reviews, no more quotas, no more performance objectives. You're one of us. Welcome to the round table. And let's check. By the way, I'm being very pessimistic. There are some fantastic Chiefs out there. I just wrote this down that I know they're so fucking good, but I know they're like coming to the end of the career. And I'm like, yo, who's next? And they're like, look, we have this girl. She's fucking captain right now. She's fantastic. And it's already like understood that once she's done, we have this other captain. He's an asshole. Nobody wants him. We're not going with that guy. But once she's done, you got to outlive the other captain we don't want. And there's a lieutenant we're looking at. We're going to make him a captain. This is 15 years after I'm gone. This is the plan in place.
Right.
If he stays as good as he is 10 years from now, he'll be the chief here too. And these guys are the people that everybody wants. So we don't want to disturb the culture here and vice versa. Right. We promote people, but we don't teach them how to lead. We send them to management schools, how to fill out Guardian software and making sure that we're accounting for all the fucked up things people do. It's crazy. We're in like this, I would argue that if you're going to give out discipline every time somebody does something wrong, I suggest you give out a reward every time somebody does something right.
Yeah, that's just positive discipline, right? But the funny thing is the flip side of what you're talking about, succession planning like that, people yell and scream, that's just the good old boy system. And it's like, no. There has to be some way to recruit and entice people up into those upper ranks so that they lead beyond, beyond the years of the people who are already there. Because I can tell you, as from experience, once you get into view of those ranks and you see it, there's a lot of people who go, nope, not for me. Great people who would make fantastic chiefs who go, I'm not putting up with that. Mm-hmm. And so it's got to be developed. It's got to be encouraged. We got to give people the resources. There's great, Arizona is a great example of a state. And this isn't all over the state, but I know that Mesa and Scottsdale have very, very robust, like supervisor programs, where if you want to be a supervisor before you get the stripes, you start the leadership academy. And then when you make your stripes, you go through like a sergeant FTO and you're evaluated by a senior sergeant on your leadership skills and your management skills. And those kinds of things are super impactful. And you create the culture of your agency in those kinds of programs.
I also sometimes see how in this profession, people kind of just float off into an unrealistic world. So I tell people, like, when you leave an agency and look back, you're looking at this mini ecosystem where you might have a 30-person agency and that chief is like, or that captain, they're like essentially like gods and some, like a monarch. But the reality is there's, I don't know, what do we have? How many people we have in the United States of America? There's 7.1 billion people in the world, or 7.2 billion people in the world. So really, you really are just a speck on the map. I mean, a speck, like a fraction of a speck. But while you live inside that ecosystem, it's like these people are like almost gods amongst men. And that's the culture that it's bred in. And I see that. And they surround themselves with people who lead them to believe that. So we've got to remove some of that and bring people back down to earth of who we are when we say we're going to be these people. I've seen it, man. I've seen people that, I think probably had no clue who I was. And this sounds a little cocky, but it's not. And the reason I say that is because I would never say to somebody who's kind of peacocking on me, like, oh, yeah, well, you know who I am. I just kind of just play the humility game, like, oh, yeah. But you'd be surprised at how many people puff their chest out when they're the second in command at a 400-man agency and make it seem like I'm talking to the Pope. It's just, and to me, it's like it speaks volumes of who you are. And you might meet a guy like Mark Lamb, who is the American sheriff, who is a fantastic human being, who is running for to be a senator. And Mark has a significant following. And when you meet Mark, you just can't help. I don't care who you are, but fucking love the guy.
I know, right?
Even his adversaries like him. People that don't like him still like him. They may disagree with his policies, but they like him as a person. I don't know if I've met a man who's more charismatic in this world than Mark Lamb. He's fantastic.
It's funny you say that, because I met him recently. He was here in town for a conference, and he and Matt Thomas, his deputy chief, Matt had just been on my podcast, and we were talking, and like a week later, he comes out to town. So I go over and introduce myself, and we're chatting, you know, because the first time we met face to face, and Mark comes in the room and he introduces me. And it's so funny you just said that, because I was just telling someone last week, like I get it. The minute you meet that guy, you get why he is so beloved and liked, because he's one of those guys who, when you're talking to him or when he's talking to you, you're the most important person in the world.
That's right.
He's just got that energy. And I was like, I walked away from that just like, okay, I get it. Yeah, that guy's he's gonna win, and he's gonna change a lot of things, because if he can get in front of people, there's nothing that guy can't do.
Even if he doesn't win battles, he is going to win the war of life.
Sure.
Because his moral code, his ethics, his behavior, and his humanity is profound.
Yeah.
You do not meet people who you can almost instantaneously trust the way you can feel or trust Mark Lamb. Mm-hmm. Guy's an amazing guy. And so I learn from people like that. You know, I always tell people, I probably learned the most from Gary Vaynerchuk. And I thought that I really learned a lot from Gary V about business. But what I've learned the most about him is the five times I've got to hang out with him briefly and how he makes me feel. And so that lesson there has allowed me to translate, as this thing grows and there's notoriety around the brand of Street Cop Training and myself, I just remember how he makes me feel. And I want to make sure that I make everybody else feel that way as well.
Right. Yeah. If you go through a day making people feel like that, like when you have any interaction with them and they walk away feeling like that was the most important conversation I will have had with someone today, like talk about a win. Right. And that's a great way to build that trust we were talking about earlier, to be able to make hard decisions, but have people know that it's from the right place. You know, I've spent thousands and thousands of dollars of my own money in the first 10 years of my career going to, you know, Street Cop style classes before Street Cop was Street Cop, you know, and like, you know, all the things you teach now, thousands of dollars. And I loved every minute of it, and it made me a much better cop. But how much time do we ever spend or invest in making ourselves a better human? You know, how much money are we willing to invest in ourselves so that it makes us a better husband, a better spouse, a better son, a better father or mother or whatever it is, you know, makes us a better leader. We typically don't invest in those things because we are under this misbelief that those things are supposed to come naturally to us, right? Like, I never knew how to search cars for hidden compartments until I took a class on hidden compartments, right? So I also didn't really understand that I should be taking self-leadership classes, self-development classes to develop myself so I could learn how to develop myself so that I could then translate that into being a better leader, a better manager, and then a better husband and a better father and those sorts of things. You know, we miss that. And we just think that, oh, it's too uncool. It's not worth the money or that we're somehow less than, because we need to put in some investment into ourselves to make ourselves better, right? Those guys you just mentioned, they put a ton of work into themselves, right? And none of it has to do with their business or their political campaign or anything else. It's all about developing themselves first so they can turn around and help others.
When you say invest, you know, the reality is investing in yourself doesn't mean you have to spend money.
Not at all.
Not in 2023 going into 2024. And so becoming a better human is free. It's merely a decision that you won't regret. And for me, I probably started learning how to be a better human being in my early 30s. And the reason I didn't practice, now I was a good human being, right? But I'm saying like somebody I'm really proud of. Don't talk shit about people. Don't get involved in bullshit, compassion, less judgment, trusting me, really having an appreciation for life and the world and the beauty of the world. All those things started happening probably in my early 30s. And there is no better resource than merely grabbing YouTube, which is free, and starting your search. And so if you came to my house outside of it at 9 p.m. when I check out completely and must shut this brain down, prior to that, you would be, I don't know, maybe even tickled to find out what plays in my house all day. So I just keep filling my brain. You know, people always say to me, well, I don't have time. I can't pay attention to this thing fully, so I don't listen to it. I don't pay. Guys, even if you get 75% of the message in from some of these YouTube videos, they're mm-hmm. amazing.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. You can watch. I'm just texting Jay Redman, and, you know, it's a real pleasure to be a friend of his. And we actually have a weekend coming up with a lot of people that very many of you are familiar with in Florida. We have a group thing going on down there. It's really fucking cool. I'm very excited to go with these guys. They're fantastic. And I'm so thankful to have friends like this. And Jay Redman's TED Talk is 15 minutes, and I think it'll change your life. Mm-hmm. Or you can just go to Netflix and hit next episode or let it run and binge watch. And dude, I like football just as much as anybody else. I really do. I didn't like football for a long time, and I'm back into it. I love it. I really, really enjoy watching a good football game. Love it. But that's me shutting my brain off and just watching something that is, I think what I like about football the most is, like, it's not predictable. Just don't know what's going to happen next. It's such a variable of, like, even at 21-3, a team can come back in 10 minutes and really change the whole fucking person. So it's very exciting for me, like the underdog style of it. I think it's, we get to the psychology, but I'm going on YouTube. You can just put stuff in, like, how to lead, how to become a better human being, how to have more compassion, how to deal with anxiety, you know, why life is worth it, how to be a better father. And dude, once you get started on it, it's like, I can't live without it.
Yeah.
God.
You just said, you're right. You don't need to invest money. The thing you need to invest is time, right? And effort. And we can all develop more time. But what I think something is worth touching on too is, like, it's awesome that you have a group of friends like Jay, right? And I know you're familiar with the idea that you are the average of the five people around you. And when Jay Redman is one of the five around you, you're in a good group, right? Like, you're in a stellar group of human beings right there. And so you are naturally going to elevate your own discourse and your own thought process and your own self-care to that level of the group. But the tragedy, I think, going on right now is there is truthfully an epidemic of loneliness, particularly in men, that I think is exacerbated by our career as cops. You know, 15% of men say they have no close friends, none. And nearly 80% of suicides are men. That's four times the rate of females. You know, 70% of drug overdoses are men. We lead 8 of the top 10 causes of death in the world. You know, and so there's a ton of those kinds of statistics out there. 97% of veterans that are homeless are male. And so when you become a cop, I think it actually gets worse because one of two things happens. You completely disconnect from everybody because of the rotating shifts and the stress and the trauma and trying to just keep things afloat at home. So you don't engage with friendships from work, but also you are going to work and dealing with not just friends, but people who want the same promotion as you, want the same specialty assignment, want to see you fail. And so it's not a terribly safe environment. We call ourselves brothers and sisters, but we don't always mean it, right? And so that environment is not a great place to cultivate all of your friendships or your only friendships. And so as we get further and further into the careers, the other way it happens is all of our friends are cops. And then we sit in this echo chamber of misery of people who aren't putting in the work on themselves and aren't elevating our own discourse. And then your average of the five around you isn't that great of an average, you know? And I think that's why it's important, you know, particularly for men and cops, 85% of cops are men, for men to have real relationships with other men where they can hold each other accountable for their actions and for the beliefs and their limiting beliefs inside their own head, but also provide them some support to go out and try those things, like just as simple as searching YouTube, you know? And I think that's really lacking these days right now too. And we're trying to change that, but I think that's a huge issue.
Well, let's talk about this for a second. So you're a man, I'm a man. Men don't allow people to help them.
Not at all.
Because we are fixers. Mm-hmm. We are the rock. We're the foundation for the most part. Most men in their lives typically are the people that we are used to people relying upon us.
Yep.
And so when we say we have no close friends, I actually think that is a subjective belief and not the reality of things. I'm going to tell you how I know this, and it's recent. The past couple of years of my life have been, oh God, like have brought me to my knees on many occasions. And so as crazy as this sounds, I'm very grateful that I went through what I went through on so many levels. And I understand why God puts me through those things because of the role that I continue to take on as somebody in the community to speak to people and on behalf of folks. And I think it really helps mold me and continues to shave off the edges and, you know, fine tune who I can be as a human being. So recently when I was in, I'm back seeing my therapist again, which is good because I don't, there's always something you could work on. And sometimes it's just like, hey, I'm having a hard time communicating with this person in my life. Can you tell me what you think about them and how I communicate with them better? Because they're going to understand why that person acts that way. Mm-hmm. So it's always good advice to sit down with somebody for 45 minutes and just chop it up and see if there is some kind of breakthrough we can have. But recently, my therapist told me, you know, I think it's time. And I was telling her, like, you know, people have reached out to help and da-da-da. And she said, well, you need to allow them to help you. If people are offering to help, accept the help. Mm-hmm. She's like, Dennis, 42 years you're on this earth and you've been helping everybody else. And so people know that. And they just, why don't you just let them help you? So put that guard down and accept the help. There's a heavy burden of guilt that I feel when somebody helps me. Like, I'm not talking about my employees who give me a hand moving shit outside because they're on payroll.
Right.
Talk about my fucking best friend calls me and says, if that's what you're worried about, I have that. Don't worry. We'd never let that happen. When I have people who are instructors at this organization who call me and say, no matter what happens, we'll always be here for you. And just, you need to know that we will always be here for you, all of us. Mm-hmm. We'll always do what we have to do to make sure that you're good. And it was a moment in time and it meant so much to me. And so I also recognize that me, let's face facts, everybody looks to me for help now. I've been able to fix a lot of things. And so now I actually have to typically sometimes hypothetically close the door on so many problems to fix the ones that I already have. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean that on a personal level. I'm saying, how do you eat an elephant, right? One bite at a time. I cannot continue to fucking try to handle every problem in law enforcement because I don't have the skill set yet to ramp it up to 9,000 RPMs. Maybe 5 years ago, we were running at 1,500 RPMs. We're probably running at 3,000 now. Mm-hmm. 9,000 is a goal. We could fix a lot more things quicker and faster, but I don't have the skill set of that yet. But I recognize at some point, and it was a real moment for me, that for the time being, Dennis just needed to be there for Dennis. I couldn't be there for anybody else that time. Mm-hmm. I just need to be there for me. Mm-hmm. And so I needed me to be me for me. And so people have to understand that. And I, you know, there's a lot of obligations. People are looking at me and depending on me that, unfortunately, at this moment, the person that you thought was flawless and could just perform nonstop isn't. And so I'm looking for you to have an understanding that I need to go through these things in my life. And my therapist said this to me, and I want to hand it to everybody else. And it's a real gift. It really is a real gift. Merely surviving is progress. That's it. You don't gotta be able to perform. You gotta be able to show up. Merely surviving is progress. I have a friend of mine that is going through a lot of difficult stuff right now. And I said to him, don't feel shameful if you have to sit down and watch movies for a few days, because that's what you need to just calm it all down and clear your mind. Surviving is progress. Mm-hmm. You're going to make it. Doesn't mean you have to. I know you got 25 things to do. Forget about those things for now and focus on the preservation of survival. It's a great gift, man. And I think a lot of people get very overwhelmed by life when we start talking about, I have this to do. I have that to do. I have this to do. We have so much. And I literally just came in here and told everybody, I'm like, you guys just got to give me a little time. There will be moments that happen. And I'll be honest with you, one of those big things in my life right now is my father's passing. He has not passed yet, but it's coming. And that's okay. That's life. I understand people are very, you know, empathetic. People can understand what I'm going through. And that stuff does rattle me at times where I can't perform the way that you expect me to. So I have to be present for that. and I can't be both right now. I know the world needs me. The world needs Street Cop. I understand. But I can't be who the world needs me to be while I'm going through these things. All Dennis needs is Dennis right now. That's it.
It's beautiful, brother. And I appreciate you sharing that. That's just so spot on. I got chills on my arms because the strength to say that, but also the depth of the work you've done over the last couple of years to understand that is advanced, to say the least. I'm going to put it one way. That's advanced. You have clearly done work on yourself to understand that it's okay. Like you just said, surviving is thriving is one way to put it.
Surviving too, right? Is progress. That's it.
It's progress. And to understand what you need and how to put that in context of what you can do for other people is something we don't do enough of. As you touched on, we're men, we're the fixers. People come to us. Now add the fact that you're a cop to it, and you are conditioned to roll up on scene and know exactly what to do in any situation. And everybody looks to you for answers. In your community, you're held up as the moral pinnacle of behavior, even if you don't act that way, but that's what people expect of you. People are always looking to you for answers and guidance. And we get more and more closed off with this belief that we have to know everything all the time. And, you know, how great is it for you that you have friends who are there volunteering support, but also that you feel comfortable sharing with, right? And I think a lot of guys struggle with that. And one of the things they struggle with most is something that you have clearly worked on, which is your self-talk and how you talk to yourself and what you believe about yourself. You know, because there's a lot of men and women listening to this right now who hate themselves, who go out and do amazing work every day, catch the worst of the worst guys on the planet, and go home and say things to themselves that they would never say to the worst gangster on the street. You know, that criticize themselves in ways that they would never talk to their kids, or they are so filled with anger and rage and frustration and difficult emotions that they do talk to their kids that way. And then that creates this other cycle of horrible shame and self-loathing because we're not acting the way we know we can act, you know? And so it's amazing. And I think what you're doing is showing people, you're kind of holding up a torch and showing people that there is a way out of those kinds of things when you're willing to do the work.
I think everybody has things in their past that they're not thrilled about.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
I can even tell you that I have things in my recent past that I'm not thrilled about. And so when those behaviors or those actions surface and I acknowledge that I was not happy with the way that I behave or responded to a situation, I'm not proud of it, but I can only learn from it. And so that's the difference. I don't continue with the behavior. I'll be honest with you. This past weekend, my oldest was being a pain in the ass. And we ran into a few people at an event in the town next to us. And my kids are young. Now, with me, they really get a little bit of a pass to curse. And so out of nowhere, I guess that behind my back, the two oldest were fighting. And he just right in public in front of all these families that we know just yells, "Fuck you." Right. And to his brother. And this is a kid in fourth grade, right? So this is not, we don't live in that kind of area where that's acceptable. You would never hear these other kids say that.
Right.
And then I was like, "Hey, don't, what do you say? You can't say that like that." And then he's like, "What do you want me to say? He's an asshole." Right. So I was terribly embarrassed by it. I got very upset with him. I poked him in the chest and just to get his attention. And dude, you know what? I mean, immediately after I did that, I didn't hit him hard, just poked him in his chest to get his attention to stop. I wanted to stop the behavior. And it reminded me how my father used to treat me.
Mm.
And I'll never fucking do it again. Cause my father did that shit to me all the fucking time. Cause he was a bully. And dude, you know, I said to their mother last night, I really want to start working on how to communicate with him better. He's a very difficult kid to try to communicate with.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I really want to work on it. I really want to make sure that I am understanding what sets him off.
Yeah.
And we're so quick to go back to the good old days where my father used to fucking hit me, blah, blah, blah. We're like, yeah, okay. I get what your father used to do. It didn't make it right. It was fucking wrong. Mm-hmm. How did it make you feel then? So right. What do you think? Passing that generational trauma on is a good idea? Are we going to break that perpetual cycle of the bullshit we're putting people through. You want your kids to be better than you? Then treat them better than you. You're not making them soft. You get them to understand how to behave as a human being. Right. You know, it's so I had a, my neighbor is a great guy. And not this past school year start, but the previous past school year start, we were all at the bus stop with the kids. Every kid in my neighborhood's got to get bused because the town we live in is like kind of a farm community. So there's not sidewalks. You can't, even though the school's close to me, they got to get bused to the school. And so he's a great guy. And he said to me, he's older, he's 10 years older than me. And we were all out there in the morning, sending our kids off to school for the first time. And he said, you ever see like anything like this? Like, I, my father never came to our first day of school to see us off onto a bus. It wasn't like that when I grew up. And I said, yeah, what a gift, huh?
Yeah.
Isn't it amazing? He like, you know, his thing was, are we being too soft on these kids? And my thing was, you should be counting your blessings that you have done well enough that you can at least on one morning be here on a day that matters so much to them to see this special moment. Yeah. Paid a lot of dues, my friend. So have I. And so let's just not think about, we didn't have this as a kid. Let's just thank the Lord that we get to experience this. He saw it differently. He's like, I never thought of it that way. I go, I know. That's why I'm here as your neighbor and your friend. Because I'm telling you.
Yeah.
What a gift. What an honor. How lucky are we that we're here to get to see our kids off to school on the first day? You know how excited I was to walk down the street with my children holding their hands? It was like one of the best moments of my life. My kid got his second stripe in jujitsu last night. And the school he goes to, they don't give him out like candy. We've gone over a year. And so I know promotions were coming soon because they show up 2 to 3 times a week. I'll be honest with you, most of the time, they don't want to go.
Sure.
And so they're getting the gist now that like, it doesn't really matter what you want to do, you're going. So last night the conversation was, you got two options. And they're like laughing. I'm like, we either going to go the easy way or we're going to go the hard way. And so the one says, well, what's the easy way? I go, the easy way is I'm going to tell you, we're going to get ready for jujitsu. You're going to get your gi on. You're going to grab your Crocs. We're going to get in the car. We're going to go there. You're going to get rewarded for going there like you ever do every single time, whether you want to stop and get a candy or you want to go to McDonald's, whatever you want to do. I said, or I'm going to pick you up, throw you over my shoulder. You're going to kick and scream and cry like you did the last 5 times. And you're going to get thrown into this car. And guess what? You're going to end up at the same place. I promise you, in 20 minutes from now, you're going to be walking into jujitsu in your gi on the mat, getting ready for class.
Bro, I just had the same exact conversation with my son last night about soccer. They're almost identical. It was like, look, you're going to practice. You can go and decide to be miserable and pissy the whole time, or you can go and be excited to see your friends, learn something new. And for him, he's always been a defensive player who's struggled with being confident in offense, and he has shot up this year. He's grown like 2 inches in the last 4 months, 5 months. And so they're now putting him in forward. And for the last 2 games, he scored a goal, something he's never done in any previous years of soccer. Unheard of for him, you know, being a defender and his own gangliness. And pointing out to him that he's put in hard work, which has gotten him to the forward and the wing position and striker. And now he's scoring goals. And do you want to keep doing that? It's like, well, yeah. Like, well, then you might as well go with a smile on your face because this is what the work is getting you, you know. But what you're really talking about is self-awareness and being present to those things, like being at the school bus on the first day. Like, what a gift, you know. This morning was bike to school day for my son, who's in 6th grade, and I'm riding behind him, and I'm just watching this kid who I used to hold in my arms, who's now got, he's almost as tall as I am at 6th grade. And seeing this body literally change in front of me and just being present for this bike ride this morning was a huge gift, you know. And that's not something I would have seen in year 5 of my career. I would have been so mired in the stress and mishandling the things that I was dealing with at the time that I never would have seen that. And I've had those same confrontations with my kids that you were talking about, where for a long time, I didn't recognize that I was overdoing it on the poking them in the chest or at the screaming at them. And then one day you realize there's a different way to do it. And now I do what sounds like you do, where we take this self-awareness approach. You think, that's fascinating. Why did I react that way? What's driving me towards that? That's interesting that that would be so triggering to me. What is that about? You know, and our kids cussing in front of other people is often shame-based. We feel like we're being judged by these other people now because we're not the parent that we want them to think we are. And so we put it on our kid. And, you know, we flame out like that sometimes. But if we can stop and think, that's fascinating. Why am I doing that? We can change. And that's our opportunity to change and do those things we were talking about earlier about getting better. And to that generational trauma, that goes right back to what we were talking about at the very beginning of these people who end up in leadership positions who don't know how to act like a human is because that's what they were taught and that's what they revert back to. Because in an instinct, if we react to a situation rather than respond to it, we're always going to default to that learned behavior that's ingrained in us from really when we were kids.
The last thing I want to do is ever make my kids feel like the way my father made me feel.
Me too. And I love my dad. Absolutely. But there's a different way. You know, it's a different generation. And we think we always say that as if we're throwing our hands up and we're like, this generation today, there's a lot of opportunity here too to do it differently.
I just think about how much your kids admire you and how much you're letting them down when you behave inappropriately.
They're watching, right? They are watching and they're learning
everything.
Everything.
You're their everything, right?
They learn everything from you about how they're supposed to exist in the world, you know? And my daughter and I, who's older, she's in high school now. We are so alike that we were butting heads when she was like three. I mean, we were really going at it. And that was the phase of my life where I know a lot of cops listening to this have gotten this from their spouse at one point or another, where my wife was constantly saying, like, stop treating them like they're suspects, you know, stop interrogating them like they just committed some heinous crime. And I was so hell-bent on being right that I was committed to the truth more than I was committed to being an effective father. And that had to change and was not an overnight process. It was part of this decision to invest in myself. And now my daughter and I, she's my concert buddy. We go to concerts all the time together and we talk, we read Stoic philosophy together, and we have a very close connection with a lot of depth to it as a result of the work that we do. And it's possible, but it takes work, you know?
When I had a daughter, a lot of people had warned me about wait till she's 13. And I've thought about that for a long time. And I've made my decision about what our relationship's going to be when she's 13. And my relationship with her is going to be, I'm better than anticipating or going to the teenage years with my daughter ready to lock horns. Mm-hmm. And so I'm aware of what I'm going to experience, and I'm going to fit more into her world more than she needs to fit into my world.
Mm, love it. Yeah.
You know, when you are this strict father to a daughter, and I don't have the experience yet, and people would certainly, I'm sure, argue that with me. But I think about every girl that was wild. And typically, it was because of a lot of times the parents were either so strict that anytime she had breathing room, she got wild, right? Anytime she could escape, she got wild. Mm-hmm. Or the parents were really defunct. But I must tell you this. Every time I met a girl who had a lot more self-respect and confidence, it seemed like she came from a great family who behaved in the ways that you and I are describing. So while it may be difficult to try to control yourself, understand the big picture item is you are setting your children up, you're setting your children up for better circumstances and a better outcome by employing the discipline to recognize yourself first and your behavior before you take action against your kids. You know, even the sexuality of your children. I'm confident in saying I don't think that none of my kids are demonstrating any kind of behavior that they are not heterosexual. But if they did, bro, I'm telling them the first guy be painting nails with my son if that was a fucking case. I promise you. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful thing to be a part of somebody's life who just wants to be seen as everybody else. You think about this. You're gay, right? And this is true. It's so identifying of your personality that it's the first thing that's often talked about. And sometimes they even self-identify as that alone to start. Mm-hmm. And so Jay, who's my videographer, the original one, you know, she's a lesbian, like she's gay. Yeah. And so, you know, I always say to her, I'm like, it's so crazy. That's like the first thing people want to talk about. And she said to me on countless occasions, like, I just like girls. You know, like, that's it. Like, I don't know why it's always got to be such a thing. Hey guys, follow us on all social media platforms to include Instagram, Twitter, Facebook group. We have so much information going out every single day, and we don't want you to miss out on any of that stuff. So check it out. Go give us a follow.
You know what's funny about that? You know, to me, the connection, and I 100% agree with that, but the connection to me is like, how many cops have that same thing, have that same experience of the first thing that people see you as is a cop? They don't see you as Dennis. They don't see me as Garrett. They see you as a cop, right? And so we bring that baggage with us everywhere we go. And we go to the backyard barbecue and we get introduced as Garrett the cop, right? Like, how often does that happen to somebody who's listening to this? And like, we get people who surround us at the grill telling us stories about their interaction with a cop or their gripe about a cop from some agency you'd never even heard of. And you're not seen as Garrett or Dennis or Steve or Tom or whatever. You're seen as the cop. And how many guys are out there right now who just want to be seen for who they are? Like, they love being a cop. It's full of purpose and meaning for them, but it is not who they are. It's just what they do. And that goes back to that need for having friends and having a connection and having people around you who see who you are outside of that. That is a huge revelation to me recently. Something that I realized I had been struggling with was I would walk into any room and instantly think, okay, if there's 20 people in this room, 13 of them freaking hate me just for being a cop. I'm being judged. They're looking at me. They're probably thinking that I'm racist. They're probably thinking that I've beat people up and used unnecessary force, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it took me a long time before I was actually in a room doing some men's work where I was confronted with that. And I got the opportunity to hear people tell me their perspectives on me. And it turns out none of them had any thought in their head about me being a cop. Not one person other than, oh, that's interesting, had the internal narrative going on about me that I thought they had going on about me. And that was super powerful to feel seen outside of being a cop. And I think so many of us drag that around with us everywhere we go, you know?
That's why we hang out with cops.
That's why you hang out with cops, which cops are great. Cops are fun, but depending on the quality of the cops you're with, there's either that caustic echo chamber or there's that cynicism that just kills us. We're trained in cynicism. It's ingrained in us. It's taught in the academy. It's taught in FTO, and it's taught throughout your career to be cynical of other people. You're taught that men are dangerous, right? Look at the man's waistband. Look at his hands. What are the actions? We are assaulted primarily by men when we're in fights. We are primarily killed by men in officer-involved shootings or in uses of force. We are taught men are unsafe. And so we retract. And even with our partners, very few of us have an open and honest connection with a partner because we have to be careful of the work dynamics. We don't want them to think that we're weak. We don't want them to think that we can't show up on the code 3 call. We don't want them to think that we can't handle our stuff when shit goes down. And we are guarded in that too. So we need to find ways to connect with other men, with other cops, with other first responders, with other people who are outside of these professions to be seen in that way. You know, I always kind of give on my podcast, I give accountants a hard time all the time. Nobody like gets introduced at the barbecue as Steve the accountant, right? And nobody tells Steve about the whole one time they got audited by the IRS and how it was the accountant's fault. Like, accountants get a free pass, you know, and janitors get a free pass. Nobody goes up to a janitor and tells them about the one time they had a dirty toilet in an airport in Dallas. And that's probably what you do too, or that's your fault, or what's your take on that dirty toilet at the DFW, right? We bring that with us, and we got to drop that. We got to learn how to get rid of that.
I remember when I was new in the profession, and you know, it was early 2000s, like 01 I started, and bro, back then in this state, being a cop was like being a celebrity. Really was. In New Jersey, 01, I mean, you were hot shit. And I remember fast forwarding towards the end of my career when I had my first son, and his mother and I had gone to an Atlantic City trip to we went to like a pool party during the day on a bus. I remember leaving this pool party, spending a whole day with this big group of people. I think their mother was showing pictures of him. And so she had got him like a knit little police uniform for his newborn pictures. And so I never forget the girl looking up and she goes, "You're a cop?" I spent the whole day with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not let a soul know
yeah.
that I was a police officer. And yeah. and I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "Oh, where?" And I said, "Where?" And she's like, "Oh, okay. Like, how you only been doing that?" I'm like, "Yeah, yeah. This is why I didn't fucking tell you." Like, I've had this conversation in 14 years. I don't know, 800 times. I just don't want to have any more. And I don't want to be rude to you. And I know that's not. So it's just interesting how we evolve where we don't want anybody to know it because we don't want to hear the story. It's not us.
Yeah.
Right. Like, you're judging a group. You're judging me based on. Maybe the way you were raised, your perspective of law enforcement.
Yeah, what you see on the news or whatever, yeah.
But the reality is most people appreciate the police.
I agree. And even out here, obviously we have our populations in our neighborhoods where it's less so and largely dependent on outside experiences. Like people's direct experiences with law enforcement are very few. So they fill in the gaps with things they've heard, things they watch on the news, things they think they see in the media, or they think they see on some crime procedural show. But the vast majority of people either outright love us or at least appreciate the work that we're doing and may hold us at arm's length, but nonetheless understand that we're here for a reason and that we need to be here for a reason. And the alternative of not having us there is asinine, right? And we've seen that over the last couple of years with all the defund movements that everyone was like, "Huh, okay. Maybe not the best idea. We need to bring the funding back and bring back staffing positions." So, yeah, I think most people completely understand our purpose and why we're here. But, you know, going back to this, telling people about the job, and that was the same way. When I started, everyone wanted a job. We were hiring like 1% of applicants to take on the spot. And as you go through those years and years and people going, "You're a cop," and "Let me tell you about that speeding ticket from 5 years ago in a different state." You know, like we subtly end up shaming ourselves for the job that we love, you know? And like, if you're not able to present yourself to the public as who you are, a cop being part of that, you know, we internally and subconsciously are shaming ourselves in some ways for what we do for work and for work that means a lot to us. And it's really subtle, but I think it adds to some of the stress and the challenges that a lot of us deal with is that we can't even be authentically ourselves in public because we have to, you know, tell people we work for the trash department or whatever.
I'm going to say this and you could tell me what your thoughts are on it. And maybe this will be the beginning of the end of this episode for us. We are bearing the burden of previous generations of cops that fuck this whole thing up. We are wearing the cloak that was created by people who didn't have or weren't required to have accountability in their actions. And they just did what they had to do to make it work at the time. And so now today's society expects this well-trained, well-oiled, compassionate, empathetic, professional human being to show up. But for generations, that was never the case. And sprinkled in were some real winners, right? Some real talented, thoughtful, progressive police officers. But overall, and I think about, you know, LA. And I got to tell you, I watched the Straight Outta Compton movie, and I could understand why there's so much friction because of the amount of, I'm not here to be judgmental. We just acknowledge the past and on both sides as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the way shit was handled, because that's the only way, and people say, "Well, that's how you had to do it there." I'm not in a position to sit here and judge how it had to be done. I'm saying because of the way it was done, we have ended up in the circumstances that we're in now, because generationally, people have been or subjected to a system of police officers, not all of them, that left a bad taste in their mouth. And that all trickles down to one thing, improperly trained police officers. That's all, right? Just a one big, if you really understand it, one big game of improper training. And so that improper training breeds and grows toxicity. It grows and breeds acceptance for a lesser standard. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about in the past. I'm not talking about 2023. I am proud to say that every cop in this country is trying to clean this shit up. Don't happen overnight, but they're trying. I'm telling you, you could see it in the attitudes and the body-worn camera footage of these wonderful human beings trying to do this great work. And just what a, if you took a cop from 1985 and compared it to the cop of 2023, complete polar opposites, same courage, same heart. Mm-hmm. But what a more refined product we're putting out now versus 1985. And because there is accountability. And so our job at this company, at least for me, is to continue that progression to get these men and women better than they were yesterday. But let me go back to what I wanted you to comment on was we are bearing the burden of previous generations that fucked this whole thing up.
Yeah, I think everything you just said, I raise my hand and endorse and vote for and agree with. We hear a lot from that generation that's still holding on, the guys who are maybe my age and a little older who are still around, that the job's dead. I know that just the way you did the job is dead.
Right.
The job is there. You know, we have plenty of job security. And not all of us know that. And that's not the issue. So are you going to adapt and come with us? Or do we need to leave you behind and, you know, give you the gold watch and retirement badge and say thank you for your service? Legitimately, honestly, truthfully, thank you for your service. But it's time to move into a different era that is involved, that does involve evolving police training and evolving the humans who are in those positions so that things as like woo-woo or new age as self-awareness and mindfulness and self-regulation are part of our training to be those great cops, because great humans make great cops. And I think we're finally in a position where the younger generation, the ones coming in right now, early 20s, they get it. They understand this. They've grown up in a world where therapy isn't so controversial. It's just a thing you can do, where mindfulness and even ideas like meditation are just tools in your toolbox. There's apps on your phone for those things. It's not unusual for them. And so I look at this generation that's coming up now with huge expectations, but also huge encouragement and excitement about where they're going to lead us, you know, and that I'm going to be long retired and an old man. And I know that my kids are going to be taken care of because the generation that's coming in right now, they've got it. They're going to do just fine.
When I was new, I was a very motivated, hard charger.
Me too.
A lot of energy. And I think there was a muster at one point where somebody was complaining about the job being dead and why did I care? It was an old, like, way older guy. Like, dude, when I started, we were working with a lot of guys who were Vietnam vets, if you really mm-hmm. think about that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we got on the job. There's a lot of dudes who were still around from like the Vietnam era. You know, my lieutenant at the time, it got hired in 1969. And so that story comes from that guy. And wasn't a man of many words. He was a very well-liked man. He was a lot of fun, quiet, but a lot of fun, like a real good, you know, wasn't afraid to speak his mind about shit, but didn't run his mouth ever. Real nice, like had your back, but you didn't have to ask him to have your back. He just was from that old school mentality, but he also wasn't like, he doesn't strike me as somebody who's a complete hard charger his whole career. Just a good overall fit for a lieutenant. And he didn't say much. And so we came into the hallway and he wasn't like it's hard to explain how he was, but he looked very old for his age. And he said to me, you know, I heard those guys in there talking and he's smiling. He goes, that the job is dead. This job doesn't exist. He goes, let me tell you something. I walked through these doors in 1969. He goes, and back then they used to there was a sign that I saw that we were hiring. And literally I came in here, put an application in. And 3 days later, they handed me car keys, a pistol, and a radio. There was no academy and there was no field training. Yeah. And I got keys to a call box on Main Street. And so he said, and back then in 1969, those guys were complaining. The guys who got in the 40s and the 50s were complaining that the job was dead. There was too much paperwork. He goes, so let me tell you something right now. I've been here almost 40 years, whatever it may, like at the time, maybe 32, 33 years. He ended up doing like 41 years on the job.
Wow.
And he said, I've been hearing the same thing the entire time I've been here, yet the job still continues. He goes, and guys like you show up and you ignore that stuff, because I'm telling you, they were saying it in the fucking, and he, you know, he said like, and the things we were doing in the 60s, forget it. And you know, you heard those stories. They were wild. Yeah. There was no account. I said, I used to ask him questions like, who did you complain? Like, if you had somebody to file a complaint, who did you complain to? He's like, there was nowhere to file a complaint. Yeah. You couldn't file a complaint against the cop in 1969 or 1970. There was no internal affairs. There was no such thing. Mm-hmm. If you came in and complained to the guy at the desk, they had a guy there that had a Tommy gun behind the desk. He said he used to point it at people and throw them out, literally throw you out through the fucking doors of police headquarters and kick you down the 10 fucking flights of steps to the old building.
Right.
To the ground and tell you to get the fuck out and never come back. That was where you can complain to. And you couldn't, he's like, you couldn't go to the prosecutor's office or the district attorney or to the attorney general and complain. Nobody was listening to you. It didn't matter. You couldn't get in trouble as a cop. And so because of that, no accountability, could not get in trouble. And so that stuff got passed down. People who experienced that in the 70s were telling you, like, these guys are fucking scumbags. And you know, to some extent, some of it was necessary, I think, in some sense, but probably a lot of it wasn't.
Well, and we still end up with these one-off situations where it's still kind of out there, right? I mean, was it Detroit, the Brave Cave that just came up recently, where these cops were bringing them to an undisclosed warehouse and some of the allegations there of this proactive unit and what they were doing to people, essentially torturing them and then releasing them? Like, those things still are out there, and they're the remnants of that culture of, you know, we don't answer to anybody. And we both know that's not true anymore.
Memphis, Tennessee.
Memphis. Yeah. Another good example, right? There's, it's still out there.
And then I'm not here to, you know, listen, dude, there are so many things to be said about that, but I can say one thing, and I'll say that right here and right now. I promise you, when those 4 to 6 or 7, whoever's in trouble there,
no.
When those people were interviewed for the positions as police officers, I promise you, at their interview with the chief or whoever it was that they got interviewed to get hired, they did not say, yeah, we took this job because we wanted to be charged with murder in six years from now.
Oh, totally right.
Didn't happen that way. Didn't happen that way.
They entered the job with all the right intentions. You go into a unit like that with all the right intentions, and it's really on leadership to keep a unit like that in line. You know, using the analogy of a bowling alley, and you put the bumpers up for your kid, like, that's what they should be doing. That's good leadership in a position like that. But going back to your description of like the Bronx, like, it's easy to learn how effective those strategies can be. And if they work over and over and over again, it's human instinct to revert to those. And we lose sight sometimes of our moral compass, believing and convincing ourselves that what we're doing is ultimately the better thing. When, you know, I guarantee any of those officers now, if they pause and reflect, and we were asking them today, was that the right way to do it? If they're able to be honest, my certain answer is no. They realize they'd lost a way, you know, and that goes back to leadership and having someone in a position who knows what's going on, but also gives them an alternative to that type of policing that is more conducive to what we need, you know, today.
I'm going to say one more thing about the Memphis thing, and I hate to make it a martyr situation, but I'm going to prove a point. And you can answer this one honestly, and I'll leave it just at this. I promise you, they went to an academy where they swung sticks at bags, did elbow strikes and foot strikes, you know, and like punching in a bag and the stupid shit that's been done for the past 50 years. Do you think that situation would have been what it is had every single one of those police officers been exposed to and trained in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu?
That's a really good question. To me,
and I can almost guarantee you that the answer is no.
To me, I see in that situation, it's not the ability to use force effectively is not the issue there. It's we're the cops, you're the bad guy, and we're gonna make you pay for it. And so, to me,
I also think though, when you train this BJJ and understand the effectiveness of it,
yeah.
I don't think that there's any guy who fights BJJ or a girl who fights or trains BJJ that goes into a situation knowing that all their ability is in grappling and these movements and goes in with the intention of throwing fists. unless you're okay. Yeah. So I'm talking about Brazilian. I'm not talking about training for, you know, UFC fighting and striking. That's a progressive thing. Most police training, when it comes to getting a blue belt, which is where you really want to be as a cop, that doesn't entail striking. Just so we're clear, it's a different part of the discipline of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. You're not punching. So if that, and I'll even throw this last one in, if they had spent time in the academy reviewing situations like this that look like this and explaining what the circumstances were when you acted like this, what the circumstances are if you act like this. And I actually think about this training that's I thought in my mind of like, I think we should train cops repetitively in the academy, like repetitively on getting worked the fuck up like a psychopath, then putting the cuffs on and learning how to shut it off.
Yes, absolutely agree. Yeah.
Like if you like that should be worked on 25 to 50 times. So this way, after a pursuit, because it's very hard, we're human beings to control ourselves. Once a guy's in cuffs, there's no more physical force being used. Obviously, we have to get him from one place to another. That's a different story, but what a solution. How many problems could we solve by learning people how to control their adrenaline?
Well, and not just after every call, but then after every shift. How do you downregulate and activate your parasympathetic nervous system to take over, to calm yourself and calm your body, drop your cortisol levels so that you're not in this hypervigilant state that goes back and forth all day, every day for your 20, 30 year career?
I hopefully am around enough or around long enough to be able to help implement a lot of this stuff. And I've said it on this podcast previously. I really believe that most of your academies are going to have to be a digital product. It's just the way it's going to be. And you could put thought into that. Everybody can listen to that. And if you're romantic with the past, that it's got to be an in-person. I don't mean at home. I mean at an institution, but it'll be a digital product. And I'm not talking about a digital product where you click the right button, the right arrow, so you can slide through. It's got a 10-second timer on it. I'm talking about it'll be so good that you'll be thankful that there's a digital product versus what it once was. Because if there's a 500 academies in the country, give or take how many, and there are only so many experts, how could all these experts be in these places all at the same time? And the answer is they cannot. So I'd rather have the person who knows the best about crime scene processing on a digital product teaching me everything I need to know versus some fucking schmo named fucking Pete, who the fuck knows, right? Who's a half-assed train the trainer. I went to a 3-day school. I'm going to teach you what I learned there. Right. And no more thought than what he learns teaching you how to do this thing. It's no good. It's no good. Can't do it. You can't. It doesn't work that way. It's got to be. We're all on the same page. This is the best way we do it. Maybe there's exercises physical after the lessons taught. Right. You're going to learn about. I think it's comical how many people have different theories on how to respond to. And it's not comical. And just in a sense, it's interesting. And people have different theories on SWAT tactics alone and different theories on how to respond to an active shooter. How could there be this many theories? It's because everybody's got their own little piece of how they think things should go. And so we've got to lay down the sword for the betterment of mankind and say, well, what does everybody think? Maybe we can put this all together and come up with something really good and give it to everybody. And while you might have some good ideas, I think there's a better way to do section two. And somebody might say, you know what? Section two could be better. You're right. The way you guys do it, that's really, I must admit, you guys got that licked. You know how many discrepancies people will have amongst canine handlers? You know, talk about people who don't get along at all, but all are also like best friends. Theories of canine handlers and how dogs work and how you should close windows or open windows or leave cars running or where the dog can go, what this can do. Bro, nobody's on the same page. Everybody's got theories on it. You know, you think about that. So there's all this friction. We've got to begin to have uniformity, but the right way. So training is not actual training. Great training is actual training. And we can be great. You got to care. You can't check boxes. You can't appease. You got to give a fuck. Got to give a fuck. You got to fucking care, dude. You all want to see it get better. You can't not care. And sometimes caring means removing yourself from the equation because you care enough.
Yeah, very true.
Anyway, bro, it's been a pleasure, man. And we'll do it again as we always do.
Yeah, thank you for the time. I appreciate it. It's been great.
That's always been awesome,
the conversations. Yeah.
Where can people find your shit at?
The Squad Room is my podcast. Been around for a minute. There, I'm on socials at the Squad Room. People can learn about what I got going on over there. I'm not sure when this will air, but for people who are, you know, we talked about some men's work earlier and all that sort of stuff. I have a retreat coming up in November 9th through 12th outside Denver, where I'm doing a retreat with two other former cops who are now facilitators in this kind of work, talking about dealing with how to be a better human to make us better cops, but just better husbands, deepen our relationships with people in our lives, how to unpack the crap that we've dealt with and that we've seen in our lives. So if people are interested in that kind of thing, they can check that out. That's at manuncivilized.com/heroes journey. I'm doing it with the men's group Man Uncivilized out there in Colorado. Awesome group of guys who know our community well because they're a part of it. Other than that, yeah, just still doing the podcast and trying to, you know, make my sphere of influence a little better every day, and including myself.
The best, dude. I love it.
Thank you, brother. So good to see you.
Yeah, likewise. Hey guys, check out our upcoming training at streetcop.com. Don't forget, we have 50 instructors nationally teaching a variety of topics. These are the best classes you're going to experience in your career. We make sure of it. You're going to love it. I guarantee you, you're going to be thankful that you went. Check us out at streetcop.com for all upcoming classes in your area.